Hi, podcast listeners. It's Chris Boyd. On KERA Radio, we're busy hosting our winter membership campaign. It's one of the few times each year when we ask listeners to support the programming that KERA provides by making financial contributions to the station. Well, we've decided to experiment with cutting those pitch breaks from the podcast. You won't hear the phone number and wonder if anyone is actually standing by at that very moment to take your call. But we would still really appreciate it if you are able to contribute. Your donation goes to support all the programming you hear on KERA, including our streaming service. And most importantly, it pays for this podcast so that you can listen to Think wherever you are in the world, whenever you are in time. You can make your contribution online at kera.org. It only takes a minute. In fact, you could do it while listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening to Think. Here's today's show.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do we know what is happening in the world's most dangerous places? We often credit modern technology with our instant access to updates from hot zones like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and now Ukraine. But all that coverage is really brought to us by journalists, flesh and blood humans, every bit as susceptible to war wounds as the people they risk their lives to cover. And as my guest today will tell us, in many parts of the world, journalists are at risk not only from stray bombs and bullets, but from deliberate attacks designed to frighten them out of their commitment to speak truth to power. Eric Matthews is producer and director, along with Tricia Todd, of the new documentary Killing the Messenger, The Deadly Cost of News. He's in town for a free screening of the film tonight at 7 at the Hughes Trigg Student Center on the SMU campus, followed by a Q&A session moderated by photojournalist Cale Alford, who appears in the film. Eric, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Murder is the leading cause of job-related death for journalists.
Yes. And depending on whose numbers you look at, at this point this year, according to INSEE, the International News Safety Institute, 16 media workers and journalists have already been killed. CPJ has a much lower number. A Committee to Protect Journalists only lists one. That's because CPJ actually makes sure that when they list a number, they've attributed that journalist's murder to their work, that an investigation's been done that actually proves or at least gives indication that the death was the result of the work, whereas INSEE's numbers also include media workers, which I think is very important. The local journalists, fixers, stringers, drivers that are the ground truth that every foreign correspondent going into a dangerous place relies on. Either way, it's one or 16 in 2 months. It's a horrible number for this year already.
Well, and it's a great point that you may not have a byline, but you can still be working as a journalist or working in service of journalism.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, more and more these days, if we're all able to publish, we can all blog, we can all commit acts of journalism. That becomes even more intrinsic in discussing the problem.
Early in the film, it comes up that journalists are people who, like first responders, run toward danger when everybody else in their right mind is running away, which is a pretty profound thing to say.
It's true. I think that in meeting a number of amazing, amazing people, Cale being one of them, the desire to get the story, the desire to bear witness, to say, if we're not there, no one is going to tell the plight of these people who are being bombed in Homs or these people who are desperately trying to get out from under the thumb of a local criminal organization. If those journalists didn't have that drive to go tell those stories, to go bear witness and report the news back to us, we as a public, as a global public, have no ability to make informed decisions. So to me, I mean, journalism is a cornerstone of civil society. If we don't have a robust, active press, how can we make informed decisions? And so, those men and women who run towards danger are very much, important and integral to our ability to function as a democracy.
Talk about why, Eric, it's so important to have people on the ground rather than sort of collecting up stories from witnesses after the fact.
Well, I think there's really nothing that you could do that wouldn't you have to bear witness. Mm-hmm. Someone has to be there making that observation with the trained experience of a journalist to really think about how they can put that story into a context that we as the audience can absorb, can understand. And it's real. It's there. They're experiencing it. That's much different than saying, you know what, the bombs are dropping, as Florence Ibuena says at the end of the film. Like, we can't just say, okay, you're blowing up the city, we're leaving, we'll come back in a few years and interview the survivors. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not the same news story.
I want to talk about war correspondents. In covering mm-hmm. conflicts, they are essentially taking on the exact same risks as combatants, but they are not carrying any weapon other than sometimes a camera.
That's true. And in fact, something that Kayle and I were talking about this morning is the importance of first aid. They may not be able to carry a weapon, and they shouldn't carry weapons, but they should carry the same training, the same knowledge, the same experience of understanding how to function in a dangerous situation. And there's training available for journalists. It's often very expensive. So independent journalists might not have the same opportunity as a correspondent working for a major news organization. But the importance of having that situational awareness, hostile environment training, understanding how to deal with digital technology in a compromised situation, and certainly above all else, understanding first aid, carrying a kit, knowing how to use it, knowing what to do, could potentially save lives. And I think that that's a big part of the new era that we're in with conflict coverage and conflict correspondence need to kind of step up their game in terms of, it's not the romantic, we start smoking cigarettes when we wake up in the morning right. and we live off of coffee. Like, you actually have to function in the war zone in a little bit more mindful way.
And you have to be mindful of the fact that if you mess up, as someone who is a civilian and a non-combatant, theoretically, if you don't know how to behave, you could get other people into greater danger. You could lead them to harm that they wouldn't have experienced if you weren't there.
Absolutely. You know, one of the people that we talked to in the film is an Iraqi citizen, Omar Fakeke, who ended up working for The Washington Post during the invasion of Baghdad. And before we went on camera, I asked him, you know, what he thought. He'd talked about bomb threats and needing to know how to check his car and things like that. And I asked him, you know, what he would say to an incoming new journalist, a journalist student, you know, in terms of preparation for conflict coverage. And his answer was really striking. He said, they need to know good journalism. They need to know the difference between background, on the record, off the record. Because as you say, like, understanding how your work is impacting the people around you is really important. You don't want to get the person whose house you're staying in targeted. So how to function, how to be situationally aware, and how to protect not only yourself but the people around you is critical. Also, knowing that it's not the movies and, you know, the SEALs aren't going to come in and get you out just because you got in trouble. You need to be able to get yourself out. And I think that increasingly this is the danger that journalists face.
Well, it's not necessarily always evident to people who consume this news at home from the safety of the United States that it used to be that journalists would sort of, if not pick a side, at least embed with one side and assume that they would get as much as they could from that perspective. And now a growing number of people are recognizing that complete coverage really requires more than that, which introduces a whole new level of danger into their jobs.
Absolutely. You can sign up and embed and be sort of chaperoned around. And by the way, that's no guarantee of safety.
And it's no picnic.
It's no picnic. And you can be in just as much, if not more, danger. And also, the interview that a journalist is going to get, knocking on the door, trying to give the community perspective in a conflict situation, a journalist walking in, driven there by a neighbor of that person who's unembedded, is going to have a totally different conversation than the embedded journalist who's showing up, stepping out of a Bradley and having an armed escort outside the door. People are going to have a different way of talking to that journalist during that interview. So it's critical that that both these kinds of journalism are able to continue, and that we allow for unembedded and embedded journalism to take place, so that there's a complete story, or as complete a story, coming out of these regions as possible.
Even in situations where journalists, where combatants on either side don't have any particular beef with journalists and recognize that they're just trying to tell a story, from a distance it can be really hard to tell if someone moving with a group of people that you consider the enemy is good or bad, is worthy of being targeted or not.
I think that's very true. And I think that, look, we see from the news today, we know what's going on in the world. It's not black and white. It's not cut and dried. It's not the wars of history books we read as kids. This is a constantly fluid, changing situation. There's criminal elements involved in these environments. So it becomes very difficult, I think, to parse out what side at any given time might even change. So I think we as an audience have to be cognizant of that and be a little bit more mindful of how we ingest the news. We have this amazing tool. We have the internet. We have the computer. If you read a story and you're suspect of it, you could easily find, you could go check the sources. Mm. You could find another opinion. You could find another another article written by someone else in that same region and balance out your intake of the news, just like we would expect the journalists in the field to verify their stories. And so I think that in a ever-changing fluid environment like today's conflict zones are, it's just as incumbent on us as an audience to question what we're reading and to look further into it. If it's something of interest to us, we have the ability in a few mouse clicks to get more information and to inform ourselves and not just accept the first story that comes and hits us.
Producer and director Eric Matthes is my guest. His new film, Killing the Messenger, The Deadly Cost of News, will be screened this evening at 7 o'clock on the SMU campus at the Hughes Triggs Student Center. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org or tweet me at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with producer and director Eric Matthes. Along with Tricia Todd, he has created the new documentary Killing the Messenger, The Deadly Cost of News. There will be a free screening of the film tonight at 7 at the Hughes Triggs Student Center on the SMU campus. You can join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I hadn't thought much about this until watching some of the really amazing footage in this film. That's something that may not come through on the radio, but a lot of what you're describing here has actually been captured on video by people who are out in the field. From a distance, a camera slung over somebody's shoulder can look a whole lot like an RPG launcher or a rifle, and that puts people at extraordinary risk.
Absolutely. I think you're referencing a very famous video, which was the first instance of WikiLeaks being apparent to the public. There's this horrible situation where these guys, journalists from Reuters, carrying cameras, were walking with men carrying AK-47s, not an uncommon thing in Iraq during the war. They were targeted by helicopter pilots that were possibly a mile away, who also, you know, a little background, had been up for over a day, were hunting a very radical and violent group of insurgents who had pinned down a military unit for 20 hours under heavy fire. So these guys were really keyed up, and looking to take action, to defend their brother and sister soldiers. And they see this group of armed men. They target this group of armed men. They get the order to open fire. And in the course of that action, end up killing two Reuters cameramen simply because the cameras are misidentified as weapons and they're walking with men who are armed. Just because those men were armed doesn't mean that they're insurgents. They could have just been locals in the neighborhood. Nonetheless, it creates a very dangerous situation. There's been other situations generally in the Iraq conflict. It's happened before, where cameramen clearly marked with, you know, TV duct taped onto their Kevlar vests with a camera on their shoulder. The camera's identified as an RPG, and they've been shot. Look, a war zone is a dangerous place. People are they haven't slept. They're being shot at. They're being targeted themselves. The whole thing is volatile and fluid. So you're taking quite a risk if you're a journalist of any kind, cameraman, photographer, or just a reporter going into those environments. And, you know, David Rode said it to me the other day when we were talking. It's just it's a numbers game. Like, you can do whatever you think you need to do to try to minimize the risk. But the more you go into those situations, the more that those odds increase, you know, against you.
Well, another person you feature in the film is Kimberly Dozier, who was working for CBS, was like chief Iraq correspondent for 3 years, and had managed to stay safe, and then was very critically wounded one day.
Well, and that's an example that I think speaks to your earlier question. I mean, here's Kimberly. She's an embedded journalist. She's traveling with a military convoy. That convoy gets targeted by a roadside bomb. Her cameraman and sound man are killed instantly. A number of the soldiers that are with her are killed or gravely wounded, and she herself was gravely wounded. There's no hall pass. You know, they weren't specifically targeted because she was a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, they were in a war zone and they were targeted because she was with soldiers.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think the risks to anyone in a war zone, including combatants, are regrettable. But everyone is an adult when a correspondent goes into a place where they know that people are fighting and killing each other. Everybody has at least understood what they've signed on for. But you also feature cases of journalists who are doing work that is not directly involved in violence. They are not working in war zones, and yet they are at grave risk for things like kidnapping and beating and, in many cases, assault and murder.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what we look at is in terms of the structure of the film and really how we see the problem. Impunity is the greatest threat. Mm-hmm. An atmosphere in which any kind of censorship can occur unchecked is an atmosphere of impunity. And to us, the pillars of impunity were conflict, which is what we've been talking about, combat situations, the war photographer is kind of what we all think of when we think of journalists in danger. It's sort of our natural inclination to say, oh, it's the people that go into war zones. But crime and corruption are the other two pillars of impunity. And I think that you look at, look, we could have chosen stories from around the world to follow. We picked places that we felt like our audience would have some familiarity with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and to some degree Syria, which had just sort of started heating up when we were kind of midway through the film, cover conflict. But then you look at Russia and Mexico as examples of crime and corruption. And you're right. Here we have truly local reporters, people who are just in their own community reporting on crime, reporting on the drug trade, or even just reporting on, hey, the city is corrupt and they're not fixing the potholes, and they're being targeted by thugs. They're being targeted in legal ways. You know, extremism laws, terrorism laws are often used in very draconian ways to oppress journalists and to get them to shut up. And if you silence one journalist by breaking his fingers, by kidnapping her, by burying them under a mound of legal work, how many other journalists are going to decide, you know what, maybe I'll just write about the local football team.
Hmm.
Maybe I won't cover those stories that actually have meaning in my community. So that censorship of one has an incredible impact on the community as a whole.
Well, it really is kind of an insidious shortcut to censorship, right? Because it's easier than trying to police, to monitor every single thing that a publication puts out. If you have put the fear of God into one person and made the rest of the staff know that they could be next, it's easier than trying to get in and you know, blackline content within stores.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, you see in Mexico at one point, the newspapers were publishing headlines directly responding to the cartel, mm-hmm. saying, what do you want us to talk about? You tell us what's safe to report, because we're tired of our offices being firebombed, our people being killed, kidnapped, dismembered, maimed. So tell us what to say. I mean, that's a really sad state of affairs for a civil society to have its free press asking the local criminal organization what's okay to talk about.
I forget who it was in the film that said it, but I really love the line that the war, the drug war in Mexico, is really a war for control of information.
Absolutely. That was Carlos Loria from Committee to Protect Journalists. Yes, it is a control of information. And, the cartels are really smart. They actually have their own radio stations. I think that you're looking at big money in the criminal enterprises, not just of Mexico, but of the world. And corruption often is directly related to money. So if you can control the information, if you can stop the negative stories from coming out, and stop these pesky journalists from digging into things and investigating things that might stir up the local community who may decide to rise up against your criminal organization. By controlling that information, you've controlled a whole channel of potential threat, quote unquote, threat to the criminal organization. So, of course, they love to control the information because they want to be seen as Robin Hoods. They want to be seen as somehow in some twisted way doing good for the community. And so to silence a journalist is one way of doing that.
And there are people who would really have loved to continue with their work, but recognize that it's one thing to take on a threat to themselves. It's another thing entirely when their family's at risk.
Absolutely. And that's, again, you know, for the local journalists, that's really the greatest threat, I think. I think a lot of these men and women have made a commitment. They're going to run towards danger. But because they're not flying in and flying out, they're not there on their own. They're there as a member of a family, and that family can be targeted and often is targeted. And that's often the way coercion works. You can silence a journalist merely by passing a note to his wife or to his mm-hmm. father, or you know, or letting him know that you know where his children go to school. That's enough of a threat to make that person consider or think twice about what stories they're gonna go cover. And we definitely talked to people in the film who, you know, particularly one case in Mexico, Luis Nahara, who's now living in Canada in exile with his family. And
working as a custodian.
Well, he was when we made the film. Mm-hmm. He's now actually, a little update, Luis is a research fellow up in Toronto, now working at Medill University, I think.
Well, that's great news, actually.
Yeah, but he mm-hmm. can't report.
Yeah.
You know, he's working in journalism, and he's doing much better than he was when he was just vacuuming floors on the night shift. But he can't report. And more than that, he can't go home, and neither can his kids. Like mm-hmm. he said to me, I saw him about a year ago, and he said, you know, my children are never going to be able to see their grandmother. Their grandmother's never going to be able to spend time with them unless we could find out how to get her to Canada. They can't go back and visit.
Does he feel at this point like it was worth it to tell those stories, given all that he has sacrificed?
Yeah, he would say yes right away. Hmm. Absolutely.
We're speaking this hour with producer and director Eric Matthes. His new documentary, Killing the Messenger, The Deadly Cost of News, will be screened tonight at 7 o'clock at the Hughes Trigg Student Center on the SMU campus, followed by a Q&A session. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. You can call me at 1-800-933-5372 or send a tweet to Chris, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Eric Matthes. He is producer and director, along with Tricia Todd, of the new documentary Killing the Messenger, The Deadly Cost of News. There's a free screening tonight at 7 o'clock at the Hughes Triggs Student Center on the SMU campus that will be followed by a Q&A with Cale Alford, who appears in the film. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One thing I really liked about the way you did this film was that you could very easily have made it about the very brave foreign correspondents that go into these places that they don't have any direct connection to, but feel the need to tell the stories. But in fact, you stress throughout the film that it is local journalists who are actually at the greatest risk, and their stories don't often get told outside of the communities where they live.
That's very true. They don't often get told. And they're, I think all of the foreign correspondents that we talk to, and I think just in general foreign correspondents, would tell you that their work is only as good as the ground truth they get from the locals that they connect with when they do land or crawl out of a tunnel into Homs. I just finished reading Paul Conroy's book about tragedy with Marie Colvin, their last assignment there. They couldn't do what they were doing if it wasn't for the media workers who basically are nameless. We don't know who they are. Sometimes they appear as a addendum to the byline on the article. But it's inevitably these local journalists that are really at the core of all the stories that are important in our world. And I think certainly what we've been talking about in terms of places like Mexico and Russia, not just conflict zones and combat zones, it's the local journalists who are going after the story, who are trying to speak truth to power, who are bearing witness, and who are sharing that to the rest of us through radio, through television, through the internet, through newspapers. And those are the people that we really felt like needed to be heralded in this film, and to really talk about the threat to the people who can't leave, who are just there.
I was really, frankly, sickened to read the statistic in the film that 85% of attacks against journalists go unsolved.
Yep.
That speaks clearly to complicity from local governments. What does international law say about the sort of moral and ethical obligation to protect working journalists?
Well, the problem isn't what international law says, because there's some great laws in terms of the wording of them. Some of them are named after famous people in the journalist community. We have the Daniel Pearl Act here that Obama famously signed in a few years ago. Mexico recently, to the great hard work of people like Carlos Loria and others, there's a law in the books in Mexico that makes it a federal offense to kill a journalist. The UN has a charter that says, journalists shouldn't be touched in war zones. The wording of all these things is wonderful on the surface. The action is toothless. They're not put into effect. They're not a threat to the people who are threatening journalists, because they're simply not. They're not leveraged. They're written as a law and never really. There's no muscle behind them. There's no teeth in it. So it's kind of a shame. I mean, I think that there is an effort and an interest in saying, let's protect free speech. Let's protect a free press. But that's just about it. I think for me, from my perspective, it ends at interest and it stops. It doesn't go on into action. And I think a telling example of that are two stories that are happening right now. There are around 20 media workers, 20 journalists in jail in Egypt, including three foreign correspondents. The journalism community and the advocacy community around journalism is up in arms. We've got campaigns. We have Twitter campaigns and Instagram campaigns. Free the Algeria staff. There's no government that has stood up and said, this is wrong. These journalists should not be in prison. In Syria right now, there are over, depending on which numbers you look at, between, say, 30 and 60 journalists who have gone missing, who are kidnapped or otherwise being held either by rebel forces, criminal forces, or the Syrian government. Again, every news organization has written an open letter to the government of Syria to do something about this problem. Not one government, or for that matter, body of law that has laws on the book saying what you're doing to journalists is wrong, is stepping up and saying, let these guys go, let these men and women go. There's two Americans that we know of, possibly more, who are held in Syria for over a year now, haven't been seen, haven't been heard from. Yet there's no official action taken or spoken about. Now, kidnapping is a tricky thing. Every case is different, and there's certainly different schools of thought about whether publicizing a disappearance or kidnapping is good or bad, whether it benefits the kidnapper or not. It's certainly a case-by-case situation, and I'm certainly not an expert in it. But to go back to your question, I think that not only do these laws need to be strengthened, but they actually need to be enacted on. And that's something that I think, you know, people often ask, what can I do? People watch the film, what can we do? Well, one thing you could do as a consumer of the news is make sure that the law protects journalism. And that laws aren't written, by the way, that don't protect journalism or that censor it.
So the people in this film and their many, many colleagues around the world have displayed great courage and great conviction in trying to get this work done. I didn't get the sense that any one of them has a death wish. So what did you learn about how they balance the need to protect their own safety, if for no other reason than to keep doing this work, and the need to really take risks in order to get it done?
I think that when you talk to a seasoned foreign correspondent, there's a constant risk assessment that goes on internally. Certainly, it's a mandate if you work for a major news organization that you have to file a risk assessment. It's a document that does just what it says. It figures out what the dangers might be so that you can plan effectively for going into that situation. These are not, as you say, these are not cowboys. These are not people who are looking to be heroic or make a name for themselves. They're committed to the notion that by bearing witness, they are contributing to civil society. They're contributing to our need and ability to know what's going on in the world, and to make a difference, to be able to report something that could potentially change a law or stop a violent act from occurring might seem kind of like a little highfalutin, but I think it's truly at the core of the motivation at least all the photojournalists, videographers, reporters that we talk to. They believe in what they're doing. They believe in the need of potentially, if they're going into, say, a war zone, the oppressed people of that community's story needing to be told so that the world understands what's happening and so that that war can end or be stopped.
Because as someone says in the film, when you leave a dangerous situation, you've essentially capitulated to oppressive forces, right? You've let them know they win.
Yeah, I mean that's if we don't go back, they win. That's a form of censorship too. It's no different than the threat of sending some thugs over to a local journalist's house. When people leave and don't go back in, the story's not being told.
There is one really amazing account in the film of some just people on the street in Russia standing up to protect a journalist who was being beaten.
Yeah, Pyotr Lipitov. It was an interesting case because he's a bit of an activist as well as a journalist. He was leading a rally, basically asking for better maintenance conditions in their small town, fix the sewers. And he was beaten during the rally. He was also an editor of a newspaper. He was beaten by off-duty, undercover, plainclothes policemen. And the townspeople gathered around and pulled them off of him and stopped them from doing more damage than they had inflicted in their initial attack, including, by the way, like old women and mothers with children and little kids, just saying, no, this is wrong. You can't beat this guy up just because he's talking to us and because he's writing things that we want him to write.
I guess some of that protection starts with ordinary people standing up and saying this is important.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, to riff off of your fund drive a little bit, I mean, if we say support public media, I say defend public media. I think that we as news consumers need to be more responsible about our consumption of the news. We need to be aware of what goes into reporting a story, who these people are, who these men and women are, not just the journalists, but the locals, the media workers. I hear a lot of chatter about defining who a journalist is. I think that's wrong. I think what we need to do is, as an audience, we need to understand what an act of journalism is and strive to protect acts of journalism. Because after all, I could commit an act of journalism. The listener at the other end of this program could commit an act of journalism simply by walking out of their house, pulling out their cell phone, and photographing the car accident across the street. That person, should that story suddenly blossom into something bigger, a criminal investigation or whatever, that person should be afforded the protections that we expect journalism to have. And I think that if we look at ourselves as members of the public as potentially being able to commit an act of journalism, then we should stop arguing about who a journalist is and just protect the act itself.
The new documentary, produced and directed by Eric Matthews, is called Killing the Messenger, The Deadly Cost of News. You can attend a free screening tonight at 7 o'clock at the Hughes-Trigg Student Center on the SMU campus. Eric, it's been wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great to be here, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Thanks to all of you for listening to the program today. My name is Chris Boyd.